Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has carried out artillery strikes on positions of anti-Iran terrorist organizations in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian man south of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Details just ahead. Russian foreign minister accuses the West of developing what he calls a grotesque Russophobia to fracture his country. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Top story, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has targeted terrorist bases in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq using artillery and ground forces. The IRGC launched the operation to destroy the positions of the anti-Iran terrorist groups. Move came after officials in northern Iraq failed to take measures to contain the activities of the terror groups. IRGC stressed the defensive operations will continue in order to ensure sustainable border security. The forces holding officials in northern Iraq responsible for upholding the law. Iran has repeatedly stressed it will not tolerate the presence or operations of terror groups along its northwestern border. Tehran's also warned Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The country will give a crushing response if those areas turn into terrorist hubs. We spoke earlier to journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas about his take on the story. He says the terrorist groups are linked to Israel, from which they receive both training and weapons.
The fact is that Israel is embedded in Azerbaijan in particular. It's embedded in the Kurdish regions of Iraq. It's embedded in the Kurdish regions of Iran. This is a proven fact. The supply of training and ammunition and supplies and logistics is going to be linked very clearly to Mossad, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has been dealing with these particular groups, Kamala and the Kurdish democratic sort of parties. In reality, all of them are being fomented in terms of a desire to break off from the Islamic Republic, just as they are in Iraq. This is the same role that is being played by a lot of the Kurdish groups there. So Iran has undertaken ground operations, you know, cleaned up before. But of course, these borders are porous, and the way that they get in and the way those supplies are ferried is very sophisticated.
Iran has been the scene of demonstrations following the tragic death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old girl who died in the hospital just days after she was arrested by police. However, what started as peaceful protests over her death has given way to riots and vandalism. Yusuf Jalali has your story.
Mahsa Amini, a name that has hit the headlines over the past days for her death in hospital after her detention by the Iranian police over her non-compliance with the Islamic dress code. While demonstrations have been held across the country demanding clarification regarding her death, there have been violent protests and riots leading to clashes with police and acts of vandalism against public property.
It's not about hijab in Iran. What is important is Islam, that Western countries want to get our hijab, our Islam from us.
Those who are rioting are in fact mercenaries who are paid by Iran's enemies. I advise all my fellow Iranians to be wise and cautious and stay away from the seditions plotted by our enemies.
Iranian officials say the death of Mahsa Amini is being exploited by foreign-backed organized groups to instigate chaos and wreak havoc across the country. On Friday, upon returning from New York, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said people's demand will be definitely heard. However, he noted that jeopardizing public security will not be tolerated. 22-year-old Mahsa was an Iranian Kurd from the city of Saqqez in Kurdistan province. On September 13th, she was on a trip to Tehran with her family when she was arrested by police. CCTV footage released by police showed that she passed out at the police station. 3 days later, she died in hospital.
While police have dismissed allegations that Mahsa was mistreated during detention, Iranian authorities have given assurance a thorough investigation into her death is underway. Now, many Iranians say they're all grieved for Mahsa's unfortunate death, yet they say the issue should not divide Iranians and harm national security. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Researcher and activist Hossein Sheikhian blames foreign interference for the latest riots in Iran. Here he is.
Nowadays, and it's for maybe decades that we have interference by proxy groups inside some countries like Iran. If they want to bring up and make a success of their goals, they use them as a tool. The protest is very something very ordinary in every country. People have demands, the society changes, they go up, and for example, today you want something and the next day you want something else, and you have to demand it, you have to request for it. They are requesting, but the problem and the pain is that the interference of the other countries, the interference of other groups which are paid to do that, doesn't allow the Iranian people to just say their demand in an ordinary way. So that's a pain. We have groups like MKOs and other groups paid by, I don't know, some regimes that I don't want to name. And you see that a simple request or a simple commemorate, for example, or a ceremony for somebody who has died sadly and collapsed in the police, for example, custody, it becomes a chaos for no reason.
Iran's foreign minister says holding a referendum among all Palestinian people is the only solution to end Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks at a meeting attended by foreign ministers of the non-aligned movement countries in New York. Iran's top diplomat said the referendum will provide the grounds for Palestinians to determine their fate. Amir Abdullahian also called on the non-aligned movement to use its capacities to help stop crimes committed by the Israeli regime against the Palestinian people. And now, more deadly violence by Israelis against Palestinians. Israeli soldiers have killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. Victim was shot dead south of the city of Nablus. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent, Mona Kandil, for the story.
Well, it seems at this time it's an accident, a normal accident in a highway, but the Palestinian man who was driving his vehicle crashed his vehicle into an Israeli police vehicle. The Israelis are claiming that it's a suspected Iranian attack was carried out in the illegal settlement of Havat Gilad. It's near Nablus. Immediately, Israeli soldiers get out from their vehicle and opened fire at the Palestinian driver. He immediately was declared that he died. It's not clear if he was trying to carry out, let's say, an attack or an operation against the Israeli soldiers or the Israeli police officers. But it's every time a Palestinian is killed by the Israeli forces, then the justification would be tried to stab or open fire at soldiers or carry out an anti-Israeli operation.
Plight of Palestinians, geopolitics, and culture are being featured at the third edition of the Palestine Festival that's kicked off in Rome.
Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo Quarter is once again home to a new edition of the Palestine Festival, a four-day initiative organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio Region and the Palestinian Youth Association, created by Palestinian expat Youssef Salman with the aim to foster intercultural understanding and promoting Palestinian culture in the Italian capital. This year's edition of the festival also has a focus on Palestine and Latin America.
Many Latin American countries have been supporting the Palestinian cause. That's what I told to the people who attended the meeting this evening. I also told them about our President Abbas being in New York to discuss a two-state solution. But when will Israel sit at the negotiation table?
A number of Latin American heads of state came out and spoke loudly, proclaiming the rights of the Palestinians and denouncing the Israeli persecution against them at the UN over the past days. At Rome's Palestine Festival, diplomats from the Bolivian, Cuban, and Venezuelan embassies reiterated their support for the cause of Palestinian people in order to restore their legitimate rights. A commemoration of Shirin Abu Akleh was held during a panel on the dreadful living conditions of Palestinian journalists in the occupied territories. Recently, a new forensic analysis proved that the Israeli sniper who killed her could see that Shirin was a journalist before firing the bullet.
In the West Bank, journalists are shot, wounded, or arrested. In the Gaza Strip, there is no internet, no power. We cannot work. Israel simply doesn't want us to do our job. 55 Palestinian journalists have been killed by the Israeli forces in about 20 years. In regards to Shirin, Israeli soldiers knew full well she was a journalist when they killed her. It was a warning sent to all of us journalists in Palestine.
The Palestine Festival will continue on Saturday with an initiative commemorating the Sabra and Shatila massacre and a conference on Italy's and the EU's political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. The festival will end on Sunday. Max Civili, Rome.
The Russian foreign minister has accused the West of developing what he calls a grotesque Russophobia and trying to fracture his country.
The official Russophobia in the West has reached an unprecedented grotesque scale. They are not shying away from declaring their intent to inflict military defeat upon our country, but also to destroy and fracture Russia.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Lavrov also said the U.S. is trying to turn the entire world into its own backyard and is throwing a fit on referendums, which are being held in several Ukrainian regions. Luhansk and Donetsk self-proclaimed republics in the east, as well as the Russian-controlled parts of Kherson and Zaporizhia, are holding the referendums on joining Russia. Moscow says it's up to the residents of the four regions to decide if they want to be a part of Russia. The West, however, has strongly criticized the referendums, calling them a sham.
Referendums have begun in the Ukrainian regions of Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. The voting is set to run for 5 days until September 27. These referendums have been blasted by the West.
The very international order that we have gathered here to uphold is being shredded before our eyes. We cannot, we will not allow President Putin to get away with it.
As members of the Security Council, we must unequivocally reject Russia's attempts to annex Ukrainian territory.
But in contrast to how the media has called it illegal, there are many who are in favor of it. Given this support, then how can the referendums be deemed illegal or a sham? Memories are short as to when this war actually started and how many people have been killed. One figure put the number of people killed to at least 13,000. Another puts it at 10,000. Keeping in mind, these are the number of deaths before the war, which began in the year 2014. Russia had tried since 2014 to reach a diplomatic solution with the West over this conflict. It was called the Minsk Agreement. Why the Minsk Agreement failed depends on who you speak to. The former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych accused Kiev and its U.S. patrons responsible for the poor implementation of the peace agreement. Yet at the heart of the conflict lies NATO's eastward expansion. The Kremlin claims that the West broke a promise that it made in the 1990s not to expand NATO after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Putin said NATO had promised not to expand an inch to the east, promises made to the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during negotiations between the West and the Soviet Union over German unification. Back in 1998, NATO was confined to Western Europe, yet today it is at Russia's gate. This shows Putin's accusation of NATO's eastward expansion to hold true. Putin therefore set Ukraine as its red line, hence Crimea, and now the referendums that are taking place in these four regions will set up a wall to stop NATO's eastward expansion. Not surprisingly, the outcome of the referendums are predicted to be in Russia's favor.
Now, the fairness of these referendums have been questioned by the West, which has condemned and dismissed them as acts of annexation by Russia. Yet there is no denying that there are many who support holding these polls. They want the war on their territory to end.
By incorporating these four areas, Moscow has set up these regions to be part of its own. As such, Ukrainian attacks to retake them can be portrayed as attacks on Russia itself. And this is where things have taken a nuclear turn. Russia can potentially use that to justify even a nuclear response. The U.S. President Joe Biden addressed that threat at the UNGA.
Again, just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime.
But the Russian president's nuclear warning stemmed from the U.S. and NATO's nuclear threat first. The nuclear threat exchange is enough to make anyone conclude that there should be a solution drawn up immediately before things get out of hand in this conflict. That, however, was thwarted by the West, who is keen on continuing this conflict. Russia and Ukraine may have agreed on a tentative deal to end the war back in April, but the former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that from happening. The agreement, in short, would have seen Russia withdraw to its position on February 23, when it controlled part of the Donbas region and all of Crimea. And in exchange, Ukraine would have promised not to seek NATO membership and instead receive security guarantees from a number of countries. The conflict itself cannot end now in the eyes of the West. The profits made from military assistance to Ukraine are staggering. Furthermore, the U.S. is using scaremongering tactics into making European countries, like the Baltic nations in particular, into believing that Russia could target them next for the sake of profits. It was reported U.S. arms manufacturers were not cashing in directly from thousands of missiles, drones, and other weapons, but they stood to profit big time over the long run by supplying countries eager to boost their defenses against Russia. And finally, the U.S. was making massive profits in another area, energy sales to Europe, in particular, gas sales. Some single shipments were bringing in $200 million. The U.S. was now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. And this is a classic case of U.S. war profiteering.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The vast consequences of Hurricane Fiona shows that Puerto Rico is still hampered by U.S. colonial control. People are showing resilience in the face of Hurricane Fiona in Puerto Rico, where the power grid crashed across the entire island due to the storm. Many who learned from 2017's Hurricane Maria are dipping into their personal water reserves and using power generators. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. According to Guardian, most of Puerto Rico is without power after a Category 1 hurricane bringing heavy rains and dangerous winds made landfall, causing severe flooding and landslides and damaging infrastructure. Hurricane Fiona was causing catastrophic flooding in Puerto Rico, the National Hurricane Center said. Several landslides had been reported. Government officials said the storm forced the closure of roads, while a highway bridge in Utado in the island center had been washed away by a flooding river. Lights went out across Puerto Rico just after 1 p.m., leaving only those households and businesses with rooftop solar or functioning generators with power. Electricity was initially completely out across the island, said Luma Energy, operator of the island's grid. Some power had begun to be restored, with priority given to hospitals and other critical community services, energy officials said. But reconnecting the whole island would take several days. This has been catastrophic, Puerto Rico's governor, Pedro Pierluisi, told reporters in San Juan recently, adding, "We are responding to the emergency as weather conditions permit." The health minister confirmed earlier that a major cancer hospital in the capital of San Juan was without power after its backup generator failed. An emergency shelter in Sabana Grande in southwest, where dozens of locals, including some infirm residents, had sought refuge, was also without power after its generator failed, according to Ruth Santiago, an environmental lawyer and campaigner for Corma Sol, a grassroots movement to transition the island away from a centralized energy grid to rooftop solar. "The only thing that can save us this time is that Fiona is not as strong as Maria, because so little has changed. The whole transmission system is down," Santiago said from Salinas, a town being battered by gusty winds and torrential rains, adding, "The FEMA money, federal funds to rebuild the energy system after Maria, should have been spent on rooftop solar. If people die, the Biden government will have blood on its hands." Fiona Center made landfall on Puerto Rico's southwestern coast near Punta at 3:20 p.m., with maximum sustained winds of about 85 meters per hour. The NHC said the storm was upgraded from a tropical storm to a hurricane. Posts are closed and flights out of the main international airport have been canceled. Flash floods, landslides, and high winds have already damaged crops in the south of the island, with more dangerous conditions forecast recently. Also, the website of Common Dreams wrote, "Puerto Rico blackout from Fiona fuels calls for immediate climate action." While pushing for a shift to green energy, the Sunrise Movement also said that the catastrophic flooding and loss of power are the result of colonial policies that put profit over the people of Puerto Rico. Progressive U.S. lawmakers and green groups pointed to the damage and blackout Hurricane Fiona caused across Puerto Rico to demand immediate climate action, along with relief efforts that center the needs of the U.S. territory's people. Fiona dumped 30 inches of rain on parts of the Caribbean island almost exactly 5 years after the devastation of Hurricane Maria, which struck during the recovery from another storm, killing thousands of Puerto Ricans and triggering months of power problems. In the wake of Maria, as Common Dreams reported recently, Puerto Rico's electricity system was controversially privatized. It is now under the control of Luma Energy, a joint venture by the Canadian company ATCO and Houston-based Conta Services. Highlighting the island-wide blackout, Food and Water Watch declared on Twitter recently that this is a climate emergency and it is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. Luma Public Safety Manager Abner Gomez provided an update in a statement saying, "We want our customers to know that Luma has been and will continue to work around the clock to restore power to Puerto Rico following the island-wide outage that began early on Sunday afternoon. While power restoration has now occurred for more than 100,000 customers, Luma crews continue to work to stabilize the grid. We will continue to work nonstop until every customer is restored and the entire grid is re-energized. While these efforts continue over the coming days, we strongly encourage customers to continue to exercise caution and stay away from any downed power lines." San Juan-based Democracy Now! Correspondent Juan Carlos Davila explained that "we know that we cannot rely on the national electric grid that is now privatized. So, post-Maria, some wealthier people have been able to install solar panels and disconnect from the grid." AccuWeather founder and CEO Joel N. Mayers estimated the total damage and economic loss from Fiona at around $10 billion, compared to the $90 billion from Maria.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Today we want to talk about an important concept in Islam, and that is waqf, or it's better roughly translated into endowments, Islamic endowment. Let's start first with the definition of waqf and the role that it has in a Muslim land society. Sheikh Rouhani, what is waqf exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Waqf has four rukns or four pillars.
Mm-hmm.
One is the sighatul waqf, and the way that you say the wordings of waqf. Mm-hmm. When you, for example, do waqf, you have to say special kind of sentences or words according to which you do the waqf. The second thing is the thing that you do waqf on, that or that you embow to the others.
Okay.
And so these rukns are important, that should be there. So, and also waqf is something that you distribute, we can say tharwa, or we can say money among the people freely for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
It means it's a kind of distribution of the tharwa among people. So that's why the role of waqf is really significant.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes you see that nowadays in modern societies, we have some classes of the people who are so much rich, and then we have numberless people who are homeless people.
Yes.
It seems that this economical system cannot solve the problem of these homeless people.
Yes.
But in Islam, there are some solutions for these kind of problems. What is one of them is waqf, that when you are, for example, when you have this capacity or capability to do something as waqf, you can do it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and help the poor people to get a better, let's say, quality of life.
That's right.
I think that's why waqf is, even nowadays, is very much important, and its role in establishing brotherhood, or like, yes, let's say a kind of prosperous life for all the members of the society, it is important.
So whatever you have as a personal property can be endowed,
yeah,
in the way of Islam in order to help or contribute to the, we can say, the life and the lifestyle of the people, especially the Muslims in the land, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, because okay, if the number of the poor people increase in society,
yes,
of course, the more the numbers increase, the more you will have unsafe kind of society.
Mm-hmm.
Because these poor people will create lots of problems for the rich people.
That's right.
The That's why it is a best solution for even for the rich people to have a peaceful life.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, what about you, brother? How do you define waqf, and what are the main categories of waqf?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It seems that the basic philosophy behind waqf is that everybody, especially those people who are capable of doing something eternal and good to Muslim community, and I mean in a larger scale to human community, should try to minimize the burden problems of the poor people.
Yes.
For example, when there's a rich person and he's capable of establishing, for example, a school or a library or a hospital, he's encouraged to do so. Granted that that's rich person pays off his homes annually, or, for example, is attentive to the needs of other people, yet establishing something like, for example, a hospital, a library, a school, or anything else,
yes,
makes it more memorable. Yes. And in this way, we find that the air or the condition of larger socio-economic cooperation, mm-hmm, and integrity becomes very much established, yes, in that society.
Okay, that's right.
This is one. And another point in this regard is that in the Islamic religion, not only the individual relation of people with God is emphasized, rather the social integration of people on the one side and their integration and their connection with God is highly emphasized in this regard.
That's right.
So when someone establishes a mosque, mm-hmm, a Hosseiniya, a library,
a hospital, yes, okay, a school, that's right,
or for example anything else for public welfare, yes, donates it in the cause of God, okay, yes, for the posterity,
yes,
for the public,
mm-hmm,
it teaches other people that, okay, he hasn't been oblivious of the needs of the of other people,
that's right.
This is one. And another, mm-hmm, one is that as people want to be remembered in a good way,
mm-hmm,
okay, we find that the name of the donor, yes, is inscribed, is mentioned, yes, okay, and even to some extent even centuries after the yes, death of that important person, his name is still shining over.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Especially when it is a school, university, or hospital, we, yes, could see the names. We can say all across. Some of them, of course, we can say on purpose, yeah, do not want their names to be disclosed, and secretly this donation or we can say allocation or endowment is done. But as you said, sometimes the amount of the waqf or endowment or the number of the places we can say and the properties are so many that an organization, and in some Muslim lands, we can say a ministry is established in order to take care of the
imam. And to regulate,
in fact, the affairs of the people. It shows important. It's really like a ministry in some of the countries, which shows the importance of the endowment and waqf. And so many people benefit, really. So many Muslims benefit from the endowment. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, what more do you have for us?
Yes, one of the really important points that should be taken into consideration while talking about waqf or khums or zakat, these kind of things,
mm-hmm,
Of course, it's a kind of text kind of system. We consider it like modern kind of text system or taxation. But the main difference here between Islamic kind of texts or this kind of paying khums or zakat, these kind of things, is this, that paying khums, paying zakat, or let's say paying waqf or doing waqf, is a kind of ibadah, is a kind of worship.
Yes.
In addition, mm-hmm, to that kind of economical aspect, yes, it has a kind of a spiritual aspect and dimension that should be also taken into consideration. That is why there are lots of rewards, mm-hmm, for waqf, for the, yes, one who do waqf.
Yes, yes.
Not only in this life, but also in the hereafter life,
okay,
we have lots of rewards for this kind of people. So that's why sometimes Muslims might ask that, okay, we pay, for example, tax for the governments. then why should we pay again? Why yes. should we do waqf? Why should okay. we pay again khums or zakat? Okay. We should remember that this is a kind of ibadah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of worship.
Yes.
So, of course, these mawqufat or these kind of payments that we have,
yes.
of course, they have its own, let's say, earthly effects or kind yes. of, in this world, they have benefits, its own effects and right. benefits.
Yes.
But of course, what matters most here is the hereafter life, that mm-hmm. in that life, you will be rewarded. You will be enjoying the, let's say, outcomes of this waqf that you did in this life.
That's right.
For eternal life. Mm-hmm. It would be kind of eternal kind of rewards that yes. you will receive.
That's right.
why it's very significant for us to be aware of the importance of waqf in our lives.
As you said, because it is a kind of ibadi work, we can say spiritual religious work, so there are some conditions, we can say, about the property, authenticity of the property, purity of the property, we can say the pure intention of the waqf or the endower, we can say, and all these cases has to be taken into account. It is not like, for example, I don't know, the surplus or the money that you put in a bank, and at the end of the month you got the interest, and the interest higher, you know, the higher the interest is, the higher would be the waqf that you put on the market. No, this is not so. And a person who is after, we can say, doing waqf has to be religiously pure. His halal income has to be taken into account. And there are so many details to be taken into account when they are doing a waqf.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Dr. Fakhwani, you are a scholar, you are a professor at the university. Can, for example, a person endows his books somewhere as a waqf or something like that? I don't know. For example, you have a specific or precious books, for example, or manuscripts. Can you do waqf on them?
Yes. Actually, for a bibliophile or for a lover of books,
mm-hmm.
it's really not very hard, but it's a kind of sacrifice
okay.
for such a person to donate his personal books that he has collected over the years
okay.
to another place. In this regard,
would you do it yourself?
Yes, I've already endowed, I've already donated thousands of my books to the libraries of Imam Hussein's Holy Shrine.
Uh-huh.
Yes, very okay. fine books.
That's right.
And I'm very proud of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel very happy in this regard.
Okay.
But
so how is the process is being done? I mean, when you do waqf a book, for example,
yes,
to the library of Imam al-Hussein. Just
yes,
give us
actually,
a picture.
I take a pen and I write on the title page of the book mm-hmm. or somewhere, I mean, appropriate on the book that this book has been donated to the library of Imam Hussein's Holy Shrine.
Do you write it in English?
Yeah, in English or in Arabic.
Well, what do okay. you say in Arabic?
No, it's equivalent in Arabic.
Okay. I know. What do you write on the title
yeah,
page?
Yeah, I write, I mean, waqf ala maktabat al-imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Ah, that's all.
And that's all. Okay. okay.
This
and
is a kind of waqf name, isn't
no,
it?
No, no. Waqf name is something totally different.
What
I mean,
is
it's,
it?
Of course, it's a formal letter.
Uh-huh,
okay?
It's a formal
it
letter.
It must have a beginning, a main text,
oh.
and a conclusion. But in order to donate a book, okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in this way, okay, it isn't that much, I mean, hard. Yet, it must be indicated that, to my knowledge, at least tens of important people,
yes.
not only from Iraq, but also from other countries, even from the United States,
okay.
donated their personal libraries to the library of Imam al-Hussein's Holy Shrine in Karbala.
That's all okay? right. Okay.
And our purpose, not only mine, but those of other, donors of books to the library, this was our shared or common interest or common, purpose that after our lives in this world, still our books will be, will prove helpful, for the posterity. At the same time, it must be indicated that, yes, it can be done with regard to one's books. However, as Sheikh Rouhani is present here, nobody is entitled to donate all his, possessions, so just a certain portion. It has a certain, percentage, a certain percentage of one's properties can be donated to a to a certain place, because I shouldn't deprive my children, for example, my wife and my children of my own properties. They do have some rights in this regard. So I have to calculate, for example, these books I don't I don't need anymore, or for example, of these books I have several copies.
So you have to observe justice among the family members and your
Rationality is the the basic criterion in this regard.
That's all right. That's really beautiful. And in this way, I think so many problems of the Muslim lands will be solved. Like, for example, poverty, lack of housing, helping the people in order to get married, young people especially, providing the dowries for the new girls who want to, we can say, get married, and so many other problems of the Muslim lands with the help of the administration and the government. This is important. Because in this case, as I heard, in so many Muslim lands, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Islamic Republic of Iran, in Bahrain, in Iraq, we have so many big organizations in order to take care of the endowment and the waqf of the society. And I think they can help a lot, because the people who want to do endowment trust them, give them the right power. And this giving power, we can say, is really important over here. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, what about you? Any other function of the waqf can you mention for us in the society?
Yeah, of course. One of the really important points here that should be mentioned is that sometimes we might mistakenly assume that when you do waqf or endow something for the other people, it's a kind of loss. But you see, while it is a kind of income that you have for yourself, both spiritually and, as I mentioned, also economically and, let's say, in this worldly life. So that is why for our people, for Muslims, it's really important that nowadays they should take it into account that they should do waqf, because waqf, as Dr. rightly mentioned, there's no need to endow all your properties.
Yes.
Just part of it. But the good influences, or the positive, let's say, impacts that it has on the lives of you yourself, the waqf, and also your society, your people, your relatives, and the poor people, and also the rewards that it has for your hereafter life, we should consider all these different aspects and dimensions of waqf.
That's right.
And do it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
So this way, of course, we can solve lots of problems, particularly for the youth, for the young generations who have lots of problems nowadays in different countries.
In order to be more familiar with the concept of waqf, I would like to introduce some books for you over here. Ahkam al-Waqf fi Shariat al-Islamiyya, written by Muhammad Obaid al-Kubaisi, has been also translated into Persian language. Based on the ideas and the fatwas of different denominations inside Islam, the concept of waqf has been tackled. Al-Mustalahat al-Waqfiyya, written by Ubaidullah Atiqi and Khalid Shu'aib, and this is another book. And also Ayatollah Jafar Subhani has written an outstanding book, Ahkam al-Waqf fi Shariat al-Islamiyya. This is, again, an outstanding book, of which I invite dear listeners to go and visit and read out these books. And all in all, I could say that waqf and the public endowment and a specific endowment in Islam can really help to take care of the affairs of the Muslims, not only in your Islamic land, but all across the world. You know, it helps you to take care of the people and the poor Muslims and the people who are under the oppression all around the world. Thank you very much, Dr. Farhouani.
Welcome.
For a nice elaboration and explaining your experience of waqf. I'm Sheikh Rouhani. Thank you much, too.
Thank you very much.
And dear listener, thank you very much, too, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode,
God bless you all. Fi aman Allah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran min laban. Inna fi al-jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Kullu man kana muhibban.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Modern history is a testament to the fact that no matter how great U.S. Western Israeli pressures and however weak or divided the Arabs are, Palestine will continue to reign supreme as the cause of all Muslims, says Ramzi Barut, journalist, in an article published under the heading Why Normalization with the Israeli Regime Will Fail. Stay tuned for more. It seemed all but a done deal. The Israeli regime is finally managing to bend the Arabs to its will, and Palestine is becoming a marginal issue that no longer defines the Zionist regime's relations with Arab countries. Indeed, normalization with the Zionist regime is afoot, and the Arabs, so it seems, have been finally tamed. Not so fast. Many events continue to demonstrate the opposite. Take, for example, the Arab League two-day meeting in Cairo on July 31st to August 1st. The meeting was largely dominated by discussions on Palestine and concluded with a statement that called on Arab countries to reactivate the Arab boycott of the Israeli regime until the latter abides by international law. The strongest language came from the League's Assistant Secretary General, who called for solidarity with the Palestinian people by boycotting companies that support the Zionist regime's occupation. The two-day conference of the liaison officers of the Arab regional offices on the boycott of the Zionist regime praised the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement, which has been under intense Western pressures for its unrelenting advocacy of international action against the fake regime of Israel. One of the recommendations by Arab officials was to support Arab boycott initiatives in accordance with the Tunis Arab Summit in March 2019, which resolved that boycott of the Israeli regime occupation and its colonial regime is one of the effective and legitimate means to resist. Though one may rightly cast doubts on the significance of such statements in terms of dissuading the Zionist regime from its ongoing colonization schemes in Palestine, at least it demonstrates that in terms of political discourse, the collective Arab position remains unchanged. This was also expressed clearly to U.S. President Joe Biden during his latest visit to the West Asia region. Biden may have expected to leave the region with major Arab concession to the Zionist regime, which would be considered a significant political victory for the pro-Israel members of his Democratic Party prior to defining November midterm elections, but he received none. What American officials do not understand is that Palestine is a deeply rooted emotional, cultural, and spiritual issue for Arabs and Muslims. Neither Biden nor Donald Trump and Jared Kushner before him could easily or possibly alter that. Indeed, anyone who is familiar with the history of the centrality of Palestine in the Arab discourse understands that Palestine is not a mere political question that is governed by opportunism, an immediate political or geopolitical interest. Modern history is a testament to the fact that no matter how great U.S., Western, Israeli pressures and however weak or divided the Arabs are, Palestine will continue to reign supreme as the cause of all Muslims. Political platitudes aside, the Palestinian struggle for freedom remains a recurring theme in Arab poetry, art, sports, religion, and culture in all its manifestations. This is not an opinion, but a demonstrable fact. The latest Arab Center, Washington, D.C., ACW, public opinion poll examined the views of 28,288 Arabs in 13 different countries. Majority of the 350 million Arabs continue to hold the same view as previous generations of Arabs did, as Palestine is a cause and the Zionist regime is the main threat. The Arab Opinion Index, AOI, of late 2020 is not the first of its kind. In fact, it is the seventh such study to be conducted since 2011. The trend remains stable. All the U.S.-Israeli plots and bribes to sideline Palestine and the Palestinians have failed, and despite purported diplomatic successes, they will continue to fail. According to the poll, vast majority of Arabs, about 81%, oppose U.S. policy towards Palestine. 89% and 81% believe that the Israeli regime and the U.S. respectively are the largest threat to their individual country's national security. Particularly important, majority of Arab respondents insist that the Palestinian cause concerns all Arabs and not simply the Palestinians. This includes 89% of Saudis and 88% of Qataris. Arabs may disagree on many issues, and they do. They might stand at opposite sides of regional and international conflicts, and they do. They might even go to war against one another, and sadly, they often do. But Palestine remains the exception. For Arabs, Palestine is also a personal and intimate subject. Numerous Arab households have framed photos of Arab martyrs who were killed by the Zionist regime during previous wars or were killed fighting for Palestine. This means that no amount of normalization or even outright recognition of the Zionist regime by an Arab country can wash away the Zionist regime's sordid past or menacing image in the eyes of ordinary Arabs. A most telling example of this is how Egyptians and Jordanians answered the AOI question, "Would you support or oppose diplomatic recognition of Israel by your country?" The interesting thing about this question is that both Cairo and Amman already recognized the Zionist regime and have diplomatic ties with Tel Aviv since 1979 and 1994, respectively. Still to this day, 93% of Jordanians and 85% of Egyptians still oppose that recognition as if it never took place. The argument that Arab public opinion carries no weight in non-democratic societies neglects the fact that every form of government is predicated on some form of legitimacy, if not through a direct vote. It is through other means. Considering the degree of involvement the cause of Palestine carries in every aspect of Arab societies, on the street, in the mosques and church, in universities, sports, civil society organizations, and much more, this owning Palestine would be a major delegitimizing factor and a risky political move. American politicians who are constantly angling for quick political victories on behalf of the Zionist regime in the West Asia region do not understand or simply do not care about marginalizing Palestine and incorporating the Zionist regime into the Arab body politic. It's not simply unethical, but also a major destabilizing factor in an already unstable region. Historically, such attempts have failed, and often miserably so, as apartheid Israeli regime remains as hated by those who normalized as much as it is hated by those who have not. Nothing will ever change that, as long as Palestine remains an occupied country.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.